Good evening and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 27th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, Deanne Lagerquist presents Called by Our Inheritance. Have I been called? Let's listen in.
The first session in a series called, entitled, Called by Our Inheritance. This session has its own title, Am I Called? And what we're going to do in this series, there are four sessions. So let me just give you a little bit of preview of that before I talk about myself and about this session. Tonight we're going to discuss the notion of vocation or calling. What is this thing? What is this idea? How might it affect us generally? Then on Thursday, we'll talk about work, mostly employment, but not only employment and vocation. On Friday, we'll talk, the title is something like Neighborly Responsibility, and what I'm doing there is collapsing all the other spheres that aren't work into that other. So in Luther's categorization, that's family, government, and church, all into that one, neighborly responsibility. And then on Saturday morning, discernment and decision making, which is probably the one all of us feel most keenly, but we leave that to the last. So, I told you my name. When I'm not at Holden, I'm in Northfield, Minnesota, where I'm on the faculty of St. Olaf College. And I've actually been at Holden a lot. This is the 10th summer we've been here. People who know me know that I have for a long time been kind of obsessive about baptism. It's my key thing. Einar Billing says about Luther, he has this wonderful image about Luther that some theologians, you can see all the parts of their theology like pearls on a string. But Luther's theology is more like a flower that has a center from which all the petals radiate. And for Luther, Billing says, that's forgiveness of sins. Probably in my own theology, baptism is right there in the middle, and everything always comes back to baptism. Wherever you start pulling, you end up back at baptism. But recently, I've become particularly interested in the way that baptism extends through our lives, and vocation is a way of getting at that. So how does what happens to us at the font give orientation or direction to everything else, especially for those of us who have infant baptism? We certainly don't want to think, you know, the game is over at that point, or, you know. So I've become increasingly interested in vocation. This is in part due to a project, a scholarly project I've been working on, and also a project I've been working on at St. Olaf, sponsored by the Lilly Endowment, called Theological Investigations of Vocation. So I've had several different takes on it. And also the other thing then to say is, it's something I've been working on, but it's not something I'm done with. So there will be some rough edges, and what you say will teach me a lot, which is one of the exciting things, of course, about teaching at Holden, is one learns a lot. Now I want you to prepare yourself. I'm not going to ask you to tell me these things or the person next to you, but I want you to prepare yourself to think by using your fingers to make a list of what you are responsible for. Okay? Just, and if you only have a few, that's fine, but if you get up to all your fingers, then stop. Okay? So if you hold up your hand while you do it, I know it's an ambiguous question. It's deliberately an ambiguous question. What are you responsible for? Okay. And I'll just kind of watch. People are using their fingers to list. What are you responsible for? Okay. And I'm watching, and when I see no more fingers going up, I'll know that your brains are engaged where I hope to start this discussion. Okay, someone filled up all her digits. Okay. Now, before we get down to the hard analytical business, I'm going to start with an aesthetic moment, maybe. I'm going to read you a poem by Billy Collins that, in my view, set some of the questions that prompt us to want to think about vocation. The poem is called One Life to Live. This is the only life I have, this one in my head, the one that travels along the surface of my body, singing the low voltage song of the ego. The one that feels like a ball between my ears sometimes, and other times feels absolutely galactic. The life that my feet carry around like two blind scholars working together on a troublesome manuscript. This is the only life I have, and I'm standing dead in the center of it like a man doing a rope trick in a rodeo, passing the lasso over his body, smiling inside a twirling of ovals and ellipses. This is the only life I have, and I never step out of it except to follow a character down the alleys of a novel, or when love makes me want to remove my clothes and sail classical records off of a cliff. Otherwise, you can always find me within this hoop of myself, the rope flying around me, moving up to encircle my head like an equator, or a halo, or a zero. So, if the question is, what am I to do with the only life I have? Or, what would God have me to do with my responsibilities? Or, is the hoop of myself an equator, or a halo, or a zero? Can the theological notion of calling or vocation be a response? Can it help us answer those questions? Obviously, I must think it can, or we wouldn't be doing this. So rather than putting it as a question, I should perhaps more honestly say, I think the theological notion of calling or vocation can help us answer those questions in a way that's hopeful and promising. And I want us to then move on to talk about these words. Let's use particularly the word call. I promised in my promo paragraph that we would use classical, contemporary, popular, and theological resources. I expect you have all of those already in your memory. I've also put some quotations up there that we'll look at later, but let's just start with what you know. This simple English word, call. It's both a noun and a verb. How do we use this word? Please use this word in a sentence.
Give me a call.
Give me a call. By which it is to make contact, right? By phone. Who else to use that word? Can you make a question using the word call? All the time, Seth Holden, we don't try to use the word call, but we use a synonym so you'll recognize the sentence. What are you called? What is your name? About some other sentences. Who else would you use the word call?
Vocation.
Say a little more.
Oh,
vocation.
What is your calling? Yes.
What is your calling? So we make it into calling, mm-hmm. And then it equals vocation. Right. And obviously what we're doing here is trying to expand vocation by expanding call, which has more ordinary uses. Sometimes we use call as a synonym for cry, right? I called out in fear.
Isn't that making contact? Oh, so you're separating making contact by phone with...
Well, I think it's different to, I'm going to call you on the phone to...
Call out for help.
Called out for help.
So how about like cat call?
Cat call, okay. Which is derisive.
Call other something to mind?
Oh, to remember.
Mm.
Yeah. I've never done this exercise with call before. I always done it with vocation, and I thought, well, maybe everyone's already done it with vocation, so let's see what this gives us. This is great. To remember.
How about call Thomas to come in to dinner?
Yeah, so to...
Summon.
Right, good. Which is, if it's for dinner, is fine, but you also, it has also the, I've been summoned to the principal's office, right? A summons to court. It has both promise, but there's also some not so good connotation with to be summoned. It's a little scary. Right. Now, let's think about how we use the word vocation. I expect in this group there are probably a lot of people who have been instructed theologically to a particular meaning of this, so don't just say what you think. But how do people use the term vocation?
Career.
Mm-hmm. I'm going in for vocational counseling. Usually means I need a career path or a change in my career path. Career, it's the same kind of word like curriculum. It has to do with a course. Course I'm on. How else do we use the word vocation?
What I'm gifted to do.
Okay. Okay. How about that one I used in the announcement about vocational technical school? That suggests a particular kind of work, doesn't it? So that we use vocation to mean maybe not professional
job,
right? So it's more, yeah, if you go to vocational technical school, you get a job. And we make
or a trade.
Or trade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things I was involved in with this project at St. Olaf's, I did a series of 4 focus groups with alums who are 5 to 10 years out of college. And when they looked at these words, vocation and calling, their immediate association was religious, right? Those who were Roman Catholic particularly had memories, especially they went to parochial school, of vocation week, right? So that vocation was a particular kind of career path, but not a career path into a job or a trade, but a career path that was priestly, right? Or monastic. So for women to be a nun or a sister. So they had that meaning, that it was something extraordinary, something religious, something elevated, something they could never have because it was this. They also had the notion that it was something extraordinary that they would never have because of something like what Simone Weil writes in Waiting for God. Right. I saw that the carrying out of a vocation differed from the actions dictated by reason or inclination, in that it was due to an impulse of an essentially and manifestly different order. And not to follow such an impulse when it made itself felt, even if it demanded impossibility, seemed to be the greatest of all ills. Vocation seemed to them really to require all their passion, something that would consume, well, maybe not consume, make full use of everything they had. And they also didn't think they would ever have that. Particularly when they associated vocation with career. Okay. So we have those kinds of associations in our mind. They go, there's another way to come at this, which is, of course, to look at the words. And here we probably want to talk about vocation. This word, I'm sure you all know, has to do with voice, right? You hear a voice calls to you. And here, this to make contact by phone, or to summon, or to be named is probably really helpful in the theological understanding of vocation, because vocation is to be drawn to something. And most often, although not always, certainly Parker Palmer, from whom I have a quotation up there, would disagree with this, but most often in Protestant Christianity, we talk about that voice coming from outside, right? That the voice of God makes a contact, probably not by the phone, right? And gives us a name, or summons us, or helps us to remember something that sets us on a path. Now, where's this Luther one?
Right there, second to the left, or right there.
Yeah, is that the one? No, it must be, yeah, it's... No, it's the billing one I think I have. This is from In Our Billing, writing about Luther. My call is the form my life takes according as God himself organizes it for me through his forgiving grace. Life organized around the forgiveness of sins. That's Luther's idea of a call. That the notion that from the outside, God calls, God speaks, and gives direction. Right? That's, we might say, is the form of this idea of vocation. And for Luther, it's really important that it not be extraordinary. That it could be ordinary. That's very key for him. Okay. But Luther always emphasizes that the formula has to go together with experience, right? So we can say this, and I would say in a formalistic way, what we mean by vocation theologically is that we have gifts that we are called to use on behalf of the neighbor. It's a real simple definition of vocation. But to say you could be called on the phone, if you've never been called on the phone, doesn't make any sense, right? You think of people who come out of like some jungle village who've never been in this, and you say to them, a phone, what's that? I think that we have something like that here. And certainly for the reformers in the 16th century, the notion of call that they presented to us maybe seemed a little bit like that to the people around them, because they changed the understanding of vocation. And so for now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the reformers and their legacy. And then say something about how I think we can appropriate those in our own time, what I think are the dangers and what are the promises. And I urge you to comment as we go along, or if you don't comment as we go along, then we'll have a big amount of time at the end in which you can comment. Okay, so it'll be one or the other, because I'm not going to fill up the whole time. Okay, so the reformers. These students, or former students who I met with this spring, who heard the word vocation and thought of it as something extraordinary, would in some ways have fit in very well in the 16th century, right? Because the way the word vocation, or even the notion of calling, was being used then was for something extraordinary. This is one of the things one of the social contexts that shaped what the reformers said. They were trying to apply salvation by grace to earthly life between Christ's resurrection and our own, okay? But they're living in a particular time. So trying to understand, okay, what happens? You're baptized into the death of Christ, and you come up out of the water, and we say you're baptized into a life like his, but there's some postponement, okay? So one of the important things about what the reformers say is that vocation is between, here we go, with the cross, and maybe the font, right? And then this culmination of time. Vocation is for this period. They're trying to understand that. They're trying to figure out if what you do doesn't affect your salvation, then what do you do? The first really important insight that Luther has here is, one, nothing that you can do is more important than something else. This is a clear criticism of the monastic and priestly system of medieval Roman Catholicism, in which some people had a vocation that made them holy, and other people didn't. Right? So they were called the word went out of my head. Councils of perfection. Right? Some kinds of work, some kinds of responsibilities fall in this category where you become more holy by doing them, and you might consequently inspire God to be impressed by you. Luther said, no, no, no. And in fact, if that's what you're doing, you're in trouble. Right. That is a bad thing. So it's part of the reason he was so vociferous about the importance of closing the monasteries, because he saw it as a real temptation to confuse salvation, which God has accomplished for you, with the work that follows after. So that's one of the negatives that was part of Luther's insight. No one office is more holy or more able to impress God. The positive side of that is that no earthly station, relationship, or activity will change our standing before God, but every earthly station, relationship, and activity can be a way of gratefully using God's gift in service to the neighbors God has given us. Now, unfortunately, this half of Luther's insight we sometimes lose, because we're so eager to say, it's not what I do that impresses God, that we then forget that there's a consequence of having received God's righteousness. Right. So Luther would perhaps agree that concentrating on not having works righteousness makes us forget that we do have work to do. Bonhoeffer's term for this is places of responsibility. He doesn't use, well, it's actually in the section of the ethics in which he talks about vocation, he uses this term, places of responsibility, and I'm looking for, here it is. He says, in the encounter with Jesus Christ, one hears the call of God and in it the calling to life in the fellowship of Jesus Christ. Divine grace comes upon us and lays claim to us in the places of our responsibility. So that Luther and Bonhoeffer and others in his lineage, when they talk about vocation, are trying to think, how do we live? And they then point to three ways that we're called, okay? That everyone is called, having said no, not one particular kind. The first is that we are called to salvation, that the gospel calls us, and that's at the font. The second is that we're all called to witness, to give account for our faith, okay? And some people say, this is the big C call. Everyone has a single calling, and that's to proclaim the gospel. And that the single calling is carried out in multiple small c callings. So how are we to proclaim? You might say, these other callings are the language by which we accomplish God's work. Now we want to be careful not to say that the work we accomplish is the work of salvation, but rather it's the ordinary work of feeding people, teaching children to read, setting a broken leg, building a house, selling a plane ticket, being a mother, being a friend, being a dancer, being a musician, right? All of those things are, if you will, the paths. And here I'm not talking just about careers. The paths we are called along. Now I'm mixing the metaphors because Luther doesn't talk about that path business. The Benedictines talk about a path in the rule that you should set your feet on the path. And the call is to get on the path and to move. Now, what the reformers say about this part is that that's a subcategory of the third kind of call. Oh, so the first call is to salvation. The second is to witness. And then these multiple callings. And one of those is to the office of ministry. Was talking to a faculty member at one of our seminaries about his childhood memories of Lutheran teaching about vocation and calling, and he said, well, here's what I remember. It was always made very clear to me that Lutherans have a different understanding of this than Roman Catholics. Because Roman Catholics foolishly, he was taught, thought that only priests and monks and nuns had calling. And then he said, and then the mixed message was, and if you were a really serious Christian, you probably were called to be a pastor. So, we're a little funny about this. I want to read you a piece from Luther on what he says in answer to the question I posed at in the title, do you have a calling? Are we all called? Luther said, you may reply, but how? What if I am not called? The answer, how is it possible that you are not called? You have always been in some state or station. You have always been a husband or wife, a boy or girl, or servant. Picture before you the humblest state. Are you a husband? And you think you have not enough to do in the sphere to govern your wife, children, domestics, and property so that all may be obedient to God and you do no one wrong? Again, are you a son or daughter? Do you not think you have enough work with yourself to continue chaste, pure, and temperate during your youth, obey your parents, and offend no one by word and deed? Again, are you a domestic servant? And do you think you would go idle if you were to serve your lord or mistress with all faithfulness as your station and orders require, and also keep your mouth under control as with a bridle? And again, are you a prince, a lord, a lord, spiritual or secular, who has more to do than you, in order that your subjects may do right, preserve peace, and wrong is done to no one? See, no one is without some commission and calling, so no one is without some kind of work, if he desires to take heed to continue his calling. Look to himself, faithfully do what is commanded, and serve God and keep his commandments. Then he will have so much to do that all time will be too short, all places too cramped, all resources of help too weak. So what Luther's and others of the reformers in the 16th century were pushing us to see about calling is that that although the call comes from God, this phone analogy doesn't quite work, right? Because the calling or the being named, it's more like maybe being reminded, but it doesn't come directly. There's a sort of indirection about the calling. The calling often, in Luther's view, comes from the neighbor. It comes from the need, or it comes from the station in which we find ourselves. He uses that word a lot. Or he talks about the orders of creation. Now, that's when I have to say something about the nature of the theological task, which is, as you listen to that quotation from Luther, it kind of makes you go like that, right? Because you think, are you husband to govern your wife and children? You think, oh, please, Luther, no. Well, he was in the 16th century. It was appropriate to his time. How do we transfer that to our own time? I think of the theological task as sort of an ongoing recycling project, you know, that we look to our tradition and we find those gems, but we have to keep recycling them. We have to keep thinking, well, how would they be useful now? Not exactly the same way. Okay, so as we try to do that, as we try to bring those things forward into the present, I think there are both possibilities and dangers. And I'm going to start with some of the dangers. One of the dangers, although to talk about vocation, that everyone has gifts from God to be used, right? The danger there is that we understand vocation only as self-expression or as passion only in one sense, okay? To forget about the suffering part of passion or to think about passion and compassion. One of the ways we hear the word vocation being used and calling today is that my vocation is the way in which I fully express myself. And that's what some of those alums were talking about, which would not have made them at home in the 16th century. Their understanding of vocation as priestly, that they would have fit right in. But the idea that vocation is what makes me, the most blatant form of this is vocation is what makes me happy. Right? Oh, now I found my vocation. It uses all my gifts and I'm really satisfied. I think that's a danger. It's not entirely wrong. When Luther talks about one's station, where one stands in life, he doesn't say a lot about gifts. I think we can recycle that and say part of how you get a station is your gifts, your talents, what you have to bring, which may also come to include your training, right? Or your relationships. And so I don't want to try and counteract that first danger with the opposite danger. We don't hear it so much now. I think more in the early 20th century than mid 20th century. And that's the notion that the sure sign of calling is how awful it is, right? I hate bugs and I need a hot shower. So certainly God is calling me to be a missionary in Africa, right? Where there are big bugs and no hot showers. Clearly, that's what God means. There's a danger on both sides to say, oh, my vocation is what makes me happy, or if it makes me miserable, clearly it's my vocation. Who? I don't think either one is quite what we're after here. That's why I had you thinking of all those responsibilities. I hope some of them are some that when you fill those responsibilities, it makes you happy. But I'm willing to bet that on the other hand, you had some that are kind of hard and aren't always fun, right? But they're still your responsibilities. They're still ways in which you can be faithful. Right. Craig Dykstra, although he's not talking about vocation in this quotation, is talking about the Christian life in general. I think what he writes in Growing in the Life of Faith is appropriate here. He says, so our basic task is not mastery and control. It is instead trust and grateful receptivity. Our exemplars are not heroes, they are saints. Our epitome is not excellence. Our honor is faithfulness. So somewhere between self-expression and misery, can there be faithfulness, a kind of responsibility in which the gifts are used well? Responsibility goes in many directions. I'm getting to the promise part, so I'll stop there. There's another related danger in the way vocation is being used these days, and that is, I think it's a kind of essentialism in which we think that there is only one proper calling. There is only one vocation. Now, sometimes that means that we have reduced vocation and calling to career. And I hope that you noticed in that list of things Luther gave and in the list I've given, sometimes it has to do with a job, or what we would call a job. Sometimes it has to do with relationships, right? And Bonhoeffer's notion of places of responsibility I'm very fond of, because it gets us all the whole range of possibilities. My responsibility as a committee member, my responsibility as a citizen, my responsibility as someone who lives next to two pretty old people, right? My responsibility, you can go on, all the ways in which you're responsible. Sometimes they're relationships, sometimes they're formal offices or stations, and that's what Luther is sometimes really good at, to think about how the office, the job, is the place of responsibility, but it's not only that. Okay, so that's one kind of essentialism. We make it down just to a job, but it can be with all those others. An essentialism in which you think there is one proper calling. That can be the one proper calling that God has for you, as if there were wrong callings. And there is a strand of Christianity that has that view, a kind of determinism and essentialism. There is one kind of career, one person to love, one place to live, and boy, if I don't get it, God is going to be really mad at me. Now remember, Luther's insight is that being a priest or a nun is no better than being a milkmaid. right? All do work for the neighbor, because vocation is always in this part of time, always in relation to people, or the neighbor. It is never having to do with how we are before God. So there's that fear that I will miss what God has intended for me. Like God has a big secret. No, just think of what it says about God. If you have that view, well, God knows what I'm supposed to do, but God is keeping it a secret. Anything. Why doesn't God just call me up on the phone and tell me? It's a wonderful story about one of my retired colleagues, Ansgar Sovik, when he was a young man and Lars Bo was the president of St. Olaf. Lars Bo knew Ansgar's parents, who were missionaries in China, and so he kind of watched out for Ansgar. And Ansgar drove for him and so forth. One day he called Ansgar into his office. He said, Mr. Sovik, have you enrolled in the seminary? Have you applied to the seminary? Ansgar said, I don't have a call. And apparently Lars Bo looked at him and said, Mr. Sovik, you're not the sort who will get that kind of a call. Go enroll in Greek. Now we all would wish for such clarity, right? That if God won't speak to us from the cloud, at least Lars Bo would. That's really dangerous. Because I don't think God has a right thing and a wrong thing. There are many things. That's why we have to have discernment at the end. The other kind of essentialism that's really, I think, also dangerous, instead of God has a particular call, there's something essential about me. And if I could just figure out who I am, then I would know what to do. Right? The Simone Weil quote has a little bit of that. Where's this Dorothy Sayers? Dorothy Sayers in her mystery novel, Gaudy Night, that whole novel is about finding one's, what she calls, proper job. Although she uses the term to mean vocation, a very robust understanding of vocation. I think you could put that all the way through. And she says, one's proper job, the big proof that you found it is that the thing comes right without fundamental errors. One always makes surface errors, of course, but fundamental error is a sure sign of not caring. As much as I love Dorothy Sayers, and as much as I think that book is really helpful, there's a little bit of that danger that we have in our generation of thinking, if I could just figure out who I am. Luther's insight, this teaching about vocation, is we already know who we are. You don't have to figure out who you are, because you just have to remember who you are, which is God's child. Who you are is already determined. So the question is, what are you going to do? Not who you are. And there isn't a wrong answer to what am I going to do. There is always something to do, to look around you today and do what's there. Now, what about the promise? I want to say four things about what I regard as some of the promises. First of all, I think this understanding of vocation that comes to us from Luther and his tradition is a counter and a hedge against the meritocracy that is rampant in our society. That your worth, that your value, that your importance is based on what kind of merit you have accumulated. It's a kind of keeping score, right? How many of you have gone to a class reunion? Or a professional meeting, right? And you look at someone and say, okay, now, what scale are we on here? You want to see my baby pictures? You want to see my CV? Which section of my CV do you want to see? It's all about merit. Luther was countering works righteousness towards salvation. A lot of Americans aren't too concerned about salvation. They're a lot more concerned about success. This teaching about vocation suggests that our identity is not determined by what we do. What we do is determined by our identity. And our identity is a gift from God. Possible in order to be made worthwhile. I am able to be responsible because I have already been made, been shown my worth. Does that make sense? Did you hear? That's what makes me valuable, the being God has made me. A second promise is that because my identity is given by God, along with my talents and my neighbors, I am both free to do anything and compelled to do something. Right? So it's a counter against inaction, which is probably one of the besetting sins of Lutheranism, is that, well, I might do the wrong thing. I might appear to be trying to earn something. Oh, I better just not do anything. It's better than doing something wrong. Properly understood, vocation frees us to do anything and compels us to do something. Don't just sit there. Do something. There is not a single perfect thing. Do something. Right? There's a kind of freedom in knowing that the worth is already established. So don't worry about whether it's the perfect thing. Do what's there. The third promise is that we need be neither captive to success nor overwhelmed by our failures. Again, really things that are endemic in our society. If we are successful, we think we are stuck, right? I can't leave. I'm making so much money. I can't leave. I have so much respect. I can't leave, you know? You get captive to the success or overwhelmed by the failure. But a doctrine of vocation allows us to see that the success isn't what makes us worthwhile, nor is the failure the end. In fact, often, and this is, I think, one of the really important promises, most promising things about Luther's teaching about vocation, is that the suffering, you know, the things that were on this hand, these are the ones that make you happy, and these are the ones that are hard, is that the things that are hard often are the ways that the office or the station or the relationship help us to grow, right? Luther would talk about this in terms of the cross, that the old Adam is killed in the midst of our answering our neighbor's need. The office can also hold you up, right? And he writes about that in terms of marriage. Marriage is not an easy thing. Right? If it all depended on it feeling nice and being cheerful, I don't think most of us would make it home from the honeymoon, right? But the station, knowing one is called to the station, that it's a place of responsibility in which one works on God's behalf, allows us, calls out from us things we didn't know were there. Okay, and then the fourth. Is the third was about meaning. The fourth is about integrity of life. It's also the case that many of us, I think part of the reason we want, many of us long for this notion of vocation as something extraordinary and having passion, because we feel like our lives are in so many pieces, right? So many things I have to do. I need a calendar. I need two calendars. I need somebody to manage me. I forgot to pick up the laundry. Is there milk? You know, I have to make an excuse to my students because I didn't get the papers graded. We feel so fragmented that if we remember that the multiple callings are all expressions of a single calling, there becomes a kind of integrity to life. It's a whole life. And perhaps can help us get some perspective on that fragmentation. So, I could say more, but I think I'm going to stop. We have about a few minutes. And hear your responses. Does this make sense to you? When I say those dangers, are those familiar? Are those things that tempt you? Are those promises, you know, do they sound hopeful to you?
It makes sense.
It makes sense. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say one other thing about this integrity of life. As I've been working on this project, what I found to be one of the richest images that anybody uses when they talk about vocation is, if we understand our vocation, it's like having a center of gravity. A vocation is like a gyroscope. So to hear, or maybe here's another one that's like this, a dancer, when they spin, you know how they keep from getting dizzy? They have a focus point. Right? So every time you spin, you focus. I'm not a dancer, but there's that focus point so that the spinning doesn't become a spiral, to have a center of gravity so all the parts can move together. It's not quite the same as voice. It's not quite the same as hearing a call. But the outcome can be similar. Other people talk about vocation as a lens because they say vocation doesn't give you something different to do. It helps you see what you do differently. And that's also an important part of what Luther says, because he's aware that feeding people and fixing broken arms and all that long list of things I did doesn't require a Christian to do them. So when a Christian does them, the difference isn't so much in what the neighbor receives as how the Christian acts, or how the Christian understands how they act. In his commentary on the Galatians, Luther gives this wonderful image. He writes first of all about the Isaiah passage, in which Isaiah says that the word of God falls to the earth like rain and does not return void, and that it falls on the just and the unjust alike. Okay, so don't think that any job that you know, you're a really nice flower and that's why you're getting rain, and this thorn bush over here, well, who knows why that thorn bush is getting rain, because what good is it? You're a really nice flower and you're a healthy grain, you know, they're useful. This thorn bush, no. The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. We all receive that. But then later he says, and when you have received this righteousness, you become the rain that falls on the just and the unjust alike. Isn't it a wonderful reversal? First you benefit from it, and then you become it. And that's one of my favorite images about vocation, is it's turning into the rain.
It just comes to mind to me in a book. It's Kristen Lavrin's daughter.
Oh yeah.
Some of you read that book. She was way back, and I like
12th century.
Yeah, 12th century. Christianity was early. And you read her books, and she has such a struggle all her life with her marriage, her children, her faith. And on her deathbed, she realizes or says, I have been the handmaiden of the Lord. And I just thought that was such a striking insight. So, you know, she did it with the Lord in mind, I think.
And
her life wasn't what you'd maybe call a success.
Right, right. And that's, I think, partly what Dyke's trying to get at, that vocation isn't a substitute for success in a one-to-one correspondence. It's an alternative. Vocation is an alternative. You may be successful, but the point is not the success. The point is faithfulness, that one has gifts, and there's an interesting chain of gift and responsibility that goes through here, because the salvation is a gift, right? And then there's a responsibility that comes from that for these other gifts. What, you know, whatever those are, intellect, artistic ability, compassion, money, office, access to power, those are all different kinds of gifts. But what do you have to give to someone in need? And presumably, of course, someone else has a gift to match your need. One of my colleagues who just retired this spring, one of the next times I saw her, I said, "Well, so Kathy, how's it going?" And she said, "Well, here, let me tell you something that happened just this week." She said, I drove up to Apple Valley to get a new microwave, so I took the truck, and in the line behind me was a family, three-generational family, speaking Spanish, buying a huge television. And I went out into the parking lot, and I saw them. They had this little Honda and this huge television and all these people. And so she said, well, I went over and I sort of made signals and I talked a little bit to the daughter who spoke English and I said, could I drive you somewhere? And they finally they agreed, yeah, she could. And so she put the television in her truck and she followed them to their house and took it out. And they tried to pair. She said, no, you know. Gas money, even at $1.75 a gallon, you know, it's not that big a deal. And you could see she was so pleased that she'd had these two gifts, a truck and time. So that to her was what retirement was about, was that instead of what she'd been doing at school, now she had different gifts. And that day it was a truck and time. That is a wonderful illustration of Luther's response to the question, how can you say you're not called? You got a truck and time, and these people get a television, and it's a long way home. Of course you're called. Does it raise questions? It doesn't answer everything. That's for sure. And it gets a little harder when we then move into those job and other kinds of orders. Because it's in a way, it's easy to say, well, today you got a truck in time. But what are you going to do over the long haul, right? Except, I think if we can put them together, it takes the edge off the job one a little bit. And the relationships one.
Can you ever say that you made the wrong career move, let's say? You've taken the wrong job. You know, can you ever, or would you say, well, yeah, maybe there'd be a better job, but you can certainly learn from this experience to head on, you know, is that what you're responding
to? Yeah, you can't say you've taken the wrong job as if now. How should I put this? There's never, Luther wrote a long treatise on if soldiers too can be saved. No, so he had some question about whether some jobs were excluded, right? That you couldn't do those jobs. But once you get rid of those jobs, like probably prostitution, you know, that would be a bad, outside the pale kind of career move. But maybe not. I mean, I can probably think of some, we could probably think of some situations in which maybe that would be excluded. But can you make a wrong career move? It's always by what criteria? Are you making bad use of your gift? Right? Is it a waste of the gift? Is it harmful to the one who is receiving the gift? Those, see, you have to Yes, you can always make a wrong career choice. Can you make a wrong choice in vocation? Can you make a wrong turn? I don't think you can make a wrong turn in vocation. Should the Israelites not have gone out into the wilderness? Well, it would have been a lot more efficient not to have gone out into the wilderness, right? But finally, I would go back to Romans, all things working together for the good. Doesn't mean it's easy or fun. I mean, you and I have been talking about my last 2 years. It certainly hasn't been easy or fun, but I think it's been faithful. It's met someone's need. It was an opportunity to make good use of what I'm good at. So, I don't know, Dan. I think you can make a wrong career choice, but whether you can make a wrong turn in your vocation,
So career is more like what in America we expect people to do. You start out and you make it better and better, you keep going.
Right.
And you stay with something. I've seen people who, their whole life, they just kind of float from one thing to the other, and they say they're being led by God, and
right.
They maybe are.
Right.
But it doesn't look like something you want your son to do. You know?
No.
You get impatient with that.
Right. Because you want it to add up to something.
Yeah.
But what if it adds up to faithfulness?
Yeah.
What if it adds up to responsible use of one's gifts in service to the neighbor? That doesn't always lead to a gold watch. Yeah.
Well, the other, or the thing I have difficulty with is if you feel like you're following your vocation, it doesn't seem right that you should have the success as the world measures success.
So you're a little more on the...
I have a real struggle with
misery
that.
Is the sign.
Misery is the sign. When you are... Okay, this is just some thoughts that come from way back. When you're following your call, you're probably not going to be paid very well. You're probably not going to be particularly respected. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things. In my family, that was part of the call.
Right. Right. Is that there should be a cost.
There will, yeah.
There will be a cost.
There will be a cost.
I think, for me, the question then is, are every choice has some costs. Right? That's the thing about this. The office holds you up, but it also constrains you. If you get success, there's a real danger. People who are successful have the danger of being confused, right? Of saying, oh, well, my success is what makes me important. They have we talk about power corrupts, and it can happen. It happens. You've seen it happen. So I think there's always a cost. Some costs are more obvious to us than others. But certainly a Lutheran understanding of vocation does not necessarily require that the cost be financial or social. It can be something else. So certainly Luther suggests to the princes they should be Christian princes. That doesn't mean stop being a prince. It rather, what he's urging on them is to use what they have as princes well, faithfully to God and in service to the neighbor. Which can, suddenly you don't look so successful anymore. Did any of you see the video Mary showed yesterday? You know, there's an example. There are all these successful people sitting around the cabinet table. And here's the moment to use that position. In service to the neighbor. I think it's time to go to worship. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Cool. Thank you.